From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a warning about PFAS contamination sent to the state DEQ 6 years ago that was not acted on.
Report lands on the director's desk, essentially says the sky's falling and you need to spend millions of dollars to address it.
How far could we and should we go in humanizing robots?
The robot will be your companion, your nurse, and in some cases it can be your lover.
And Motown legend Duke Fakir of the Four Tops remembers the little studio on West Grand Boulevard.
Of all the recordings that we did that came out of there with all the different personalities, it's just amazing. We go down there and I say, wow, we did all that in here? What a wonderful, wonderful place.
Those stories and much more for you today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. As Bob Dylan wrote, you better start swimming or you'll sink like a stone, for the times they are a-changin'. Well, those lyrics apply to the North American International Auto Show. After some 30 years, big changes are in the wind. Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes says it is crucial the organizers of the show, the Detroit Auto Dealers Association, make an appropriately aggressive decision for fast-changing times. Daniel, why is that?
Because people or at least automakers, are abandoning auto shows. The German automakers have essentially abandoned Detroit, with the exception of the Volkswagen brand, but Audi, BMW, Porsche, Mercedes, they're all out. And they're also leaving auto shows in Paris and in Frankfurt and Geneva. In Western Europe and in North America, auto shows are kind of becoming very 20th century. And Detroit really prides itself in the last 30 years of being a must-do stop on the global circuit. And the truth of the matter is that it's not anymore, and it has to reinvent itself.
So, Daniel, you, Nora Naughton, and Ian Thibodeau reported earlier this week in the Detroit News it certainly looks like the 2020 iteration of the Detroit Auto Show is going to be in June. Tell us some of the ideas that are being kicked around for really reimagining the show.
Well, I think what they're looking at is making it more experiential. What's growing on the automotive scene are festivals, are things where the first time they see the all-new vehicle, they actually see it moving. They see it going over, if it's a truck or an SUV, going over an obstacle course, or if it's a sleek racing kind of vehicle, actually racing. There's a festival in Britain that's actually going on this coming weekend called the Goodwood Festival of Speed that's in its 25th year, and it has been growing each and every year, and it really focuses on people having the experience of touching it, seeing it move, seeing it being driven, seeing it being put through its paces, seeing it race, seeing it fail. That's kind of the direction they want to go. And I think what people are thinking about here is we've got the Grand Prix on Belle Isle the first weekend in June. You've got the fireworks at the end of June. It's a time of year before all the big vacation crush starts to come along. And I think they see that the auto show can essentially become somewhat disaggregated. By that, I mean Ford, for example, could have events inside the train station lobby. General Motors has its position on the riverfront. They've got Chrysler House at Griswold and Fort. We've got outside venues like Grand Circus Park and Beacon Park now, near DTE, and there's just a lot of things going on where they could use the facilities of downtown. The other thing I think people are thinking about is you can also enlist some of the major players in downtown to become kind of part of the team. Dan Gilbert and his real estate, the Illich family with the District Detroit, maybe Wayne State University. I mean, the sky's the limit here in terms of how creative you can be. Because I think the manufacturers have come to the conclusion that the auto shows are not about reaching media anymore. They can reach us at any time, 24/7, via the web. If they want to get their message out, they host their own events that are not during an auto show so they can maximize the attention and maximize the management of their message.
Looking at this and thinking about this, what would be the main challenges of, say, doing the show in June and all of these different venues?
Well, a couple of things come to mind. One is the renovation of Cobo has made Cobo a legitimate contender for business on the convention circuit. I'm told that they need at least 3,000 more downtown hotel rooms to just be average. Just be average, not be market leading, but to be just average. So if you have a lot of things going on downtown at the same time, at a time like June, as opposed to January, the demand for hotel rooms is going to be higher, you would assume. That's one example. Can DTE supply the power that you need on the grid to keep Cobo properly air conditioned if you have a heat spike in the middle of June, which we all know can happen?
Yes, indeed.
Can the city provide the services from police, fire, EMS, when you have an awful lot of people downtown doing an awful lot of things in a lot of different places? I think a lot of that stuff is probably manageable. I think the city is going to be much more of a city saying, how can we do this, not 16 reasons why they can't do it. But I think the timing is right here. You have corporate players and business players who want to be part of Detroit. They want to show their employees, potentially their customers, depending on what kind of business they are, that they are engaged in the civic life of their community. And if the Detroit auto dealers who organize this show are smart, they're going to grasp that and they're going to grab onto it and say, how can we partner with you? Because when they launched this international phase of the auto show in 1989, Detroit was a very, very different place, and was a very different place in the 90s and in the 2000s into the bankruptcy. Now you have a lot more potential partners, and I think they'd be smart to try and build those partnerships and make the show into something that people look at Detroit and say, hey, these guys get it. They have moved beyond Auto 1.0. They're moving into Auto 2.0, and they're trying to grasp the future.
Detroit News business columnist Daniel Howes. Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
Let's turn now to a buyback program that could help thousands of struggling homeowners in Detroit avoid losing their homes to foreclosure. Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick is with us now. What is this foreclosure buyback program? How does it work?
Well, it involves the city of Detroit using a process called the right of first refusal process. So these are homes that have already been foreclosed by Wayne County. But before they go to the annual tax auction in the fall, the city gets a chance to sort of pull out homes that it might want. So it exercises that right on behalf of some homeowners who have been foreclosed with, in this case, the idea of allowing them to stay in those homes.
So this comes out of last week's settlement between the ACLU and Detroit and Wayne County. Remind us again, why was this necessary?
Well, it partially comes out of that settlement. The city actually ran a small pilot version of this program last year, but the lawsuit that you're talking about was filed by the ACLU a couple years back, and it claimed that the way that Wayne County and the city of Detroit were going about foreclosing on properties for property taxes was unconstitutional on a couple of bases, but basically that there were people the city of Detroit has an exemption for people who are low income to can avoid paying property taxes altogether in some cases. And a lot of people who were foreclosed on would have qualified for that, but they either didn't know about it or couldn't get it because the process was pretty arduous. And then there were also some other issues in there, but this settlement is basically a way of giving people who would have qualified for or should have qualified for that low income property tax exemption in years past a chance to stay in their homes now. And there are also some other elements in that settlement about making the property tax exemption better known to homeowners. But this was just a way of sort of coming out of what's been the city's kind of tax foreclosure crisis, a way of making it easier for some people to stay in their homes going forward.
Yeah, so I guess practically speaking, really on the ground level, what does this settlement and this buyback mean for Detroit homeowners, and who does this really help?
In terms of the settlement, it helps people who are homeowners who would have qualified for that poverty tax exemption. In the future, hopefully, they actually sign up and get that exemption. But for now, in the terms of this buyback program, people who should have qualified for it should be able to stay in their homes, who own their homes, should be able to stay in those homes for $1,000. So they get their homes back out of foreclosure, and they only have to pay $1,000 for that.
Now, you spoke with some homeowners. What did you hear?
I talked to a few folks. Shannon Robertson actually was there, and he's one of the homeowners that now is eligible for this program because he would have qualified for the poverty tax exemption, and here's what he had to say.
My family home has been in my family for about, 48 years now. Yeah, so just down here just to save my property.
But this program doesn't only cover people who are homeowners. It also covers people who are maybe renters, whose landlords allow the property to go into tax foreclosure. And that was the case for Michelle Beltillis. And she says she's put about $6,000 worth of work into her home that she doesn't own, but her landlord allowed to go into foreclosure. And she's says it means everything to her to be able to keep it for herself and her four kids.
I mean the world, my life. My mother died in that house. My everything is there. So it's emotional for me.
You can hear in her voice, it's for some people, this really is a lifeline for them, but it's sort of a last minute process when the homes are already in foreclosure. So there's a lot of uncertainty for them leading up to that.
And Sarah, there is a deadline tomorrow, which seems pretty quick for such a major shift in policy. What is it and to whom does it pertain?
So the deadline is actually something that had been set by the Wayne County Treasurer for the entire buyback program, basically because the treasurer needs to pull these homes out of the auction and reserve them for the cities to exercise right of first refusal. The city has requested an extension for that until the end of the month. And unofficially, a couple sources seem to indicate that that extension will probably be granted. But we won't know until tomorrow when the Wayne County Treasurer, Eric Sabree, is going to hold a press conference talking about this year's tax foreclosure numbers.
Sarah, put this in broader perspective for us, if you will. Detroit has been ravaged by home foreclosures for a lot of years now. What does this settlement and buyback program mean for residents and the future of the city's housing market?
It means a lot, obviously, to people who are going to be able to stay in their homes, but the city expanded the program this year partially because of this settlement over its past handling of tax foreclosures. But it's still only about 300 people, and this is at the very end of the foreclosure process when homes have already gone into foreclosure, so it's sort of a last-minute thing that obviously, while very important to the people who can get in this program, we're talking about, I've seen some numbers recently, as many as more than one in three Detroit homes went through tax foreclosure over the past 15 years or so. I mean, that's a pretty stunning number. And, you know, not all those homes were occupied, but tens of thousands of people have been displaced by this. So going forward, the city will be handling things differently. There will be more options for people to stay in their homes, even if they have tax foreclosure or property tax problems. But it's, you know, really kind of a drop in the bucket compared to a lot of the damage that's already been done to Detroit and to its housing.
Michigan Radio's Sarah Swick. Sarah, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, plans for Michigan's first World War II memorial get a boost. Plus, Duke Fakir of the Four Tops. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Governor Snyder recently signed a new tax law offering a helping hand to a proposed World War II memorial to be built in Oakland County. This new law adds the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial to the organizations to which you can donate through your state income tax return. Deb Hollis of the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial is here now. Deb, how long has your group been trying to get the memorial to go from plan to actual groundbreaking?
You know, we started as Honor Flight Michigan back in 2007. And that mission was completed by 2011. And so it was at that point that the memorial was conceived, so to speak. But it took a year or two, really, to get the plan together, gather our team of architect, contractor, sculptor, et cetera. So we did our big kickoff in 2013 after we got resolutions from the House and Senate in Michigan recognizing this memorial as the state's official tribute to its contributions during World War II.
And I know the city of Royal Oak has approved your plan for this memorial to be built at a city park right at the corner of 13 Mile Road in Woodward. What would this look like?
So the memorial spans about 3/4 acre. There is an existing oval ring of oak trees at that site in Memorial Park right now. It's at the northeast corner of 13 and Woodward. And so within that existing circle of trees, there will be 9 life-size bronze statues representing land, air, and sea, all presented through a Michigan theme, helping people understand what Michigan did during the war. They will have home front and war front perspectives in each of those statue scenes. Then we will have 13 10-foot-high pillars, six of which will represent things such as service, sacrifice, labor, industry, commitment, and change. So the last component is a map. We like to say it's the who, the what, and the where of the Michigan story, which will be about 30 feet by 40 feet, made out of granite in the ground, that will be etched with a variety of social, industrial, and military points of interest so that you can literally take a walking tour across the state and, again, learn about the contributions and what we did. The center of the memorial is a big grass amphitheater space. What we want, and we've talked to a lot of our World War II veterans, and they love the concept that this is going to be an interactive space. What we didn't want, our architect said from day one, we don't want this to be a marble garden. We don't want people to come once, pay their respects, and never come back. Our goal is to honor their legacy and to educate future generations. And we believe we're going to educate them more if they return time and again. You're going to learn something new each time you're there. So it's an interactive space. That amphitheater space is going to be an ice rink in the winter. There will be interactive technology on site, and there will be an on-site curriculum so people can go on and download the curriculum. Teachers can take students on field trips. Civic organizations can take, you know, group events there. Families can go connect into the on-site technology and learn about that statue of Rosie the Riveter.
So the whole thing is that this is to be very interactive and kind of fluid, kind of always changing.
Yeah.
You know, it is actually kind of jaw-dropping to think that well over 70 years after the last bullet flew and the last bomb fell in World War II, that Michigan has yet to have a monument to its World War II veterans.
It's stunning, actually. And that part of Memorial Park was dedicated in 1948 as a World War II park. And the memorial was just never built. So it's really the perfect space for us to use. And Royal Oak has been incredible as a support system. We currently do have a signed contract with the city that talks about the perpetual care of the memorial that they will assume the care for. The memorial will technically be gifted back to the city. And we've got a real ironclad contract so that it will be maintained and cared for generations to come. So that was very important to us.
Why have you and the others involved with the Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial, why have you made this such a personal cause?
I would say almost everybody on our board has a father or an uncle who was in World War II. I think every single board member, in fact. You know, we've all grown up with great respect for the military, wanting to honor these men and women. And after we were involved in the honor flight trips, which many of us were, and got to know these veterans and hear their stories, they became like family to us. And when honor flight was done, we had the choice of shuttering our doors and saying mission accomplished or doing something more. And there was no question to us that we were going to do more because their legacy deserves to be heard and to be remembered and to be honored. It's so important. Everything we have today is because of that generation. And we feel it's our duty at this point to teach current and future generations about that.
And what is this new law that lets people tick the box and say Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial, I'll make a donation? What does it mean for your effort?
Well, it gives us great statewide exposure is what it does. The form is actually called the Michigan Voluntary Contribution Schedule. It's not part of the actual tax return. It's a separate form that you have to use. So you can go on there and donate $5, $10, or a much higher amount of your choosing. And it's a state memorial. It's not a Royal Oak memorial, not an Oakland County memorial. It is a Michigan memorial. So these bills are really so critical to us to get that statewide exposure. And it was Senator Steve Beda and Senator Marty Nolenberg who worked on these bills for us. And we're so grateful for their work on our behalf. They've been really great supporters of this project.
And you can find out more and see renderings of the proposed memorial. We put a link for you at the stateside page at michiganradio.org. Deb Hollis, Michigan World War II Legacy Memorial, honoring sacrifice, celebrating freedom. Thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thank you so much, Cindy.
Hallelujah. That is the beating heart of Motown music, the Four Tops, with the chart-topping 1966 hit, Reach Out, I'll Be There, one of such a long string of hits for the Four Tops. The Four Tops, the Temptations, and the Stylistics will be performing July 14th at the Michigan Lottery Amphitheater at Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights, the Legends of Motown show. And with us now, one of those legends, Abdul Duke Fakir, a founding member of the Four Tops. And Duke, speaking as someone who has been singing along with you in the car since the 60s, it is a pleasure to welcome you to Stateside.
Well, it's my pleasure speaking with you, Cynthia.
Well, what is it that you find about that Motown music? Why do you think it's still thrilling audiences all these years later?
Well, first of all, the sound was very crisp and extremely well done. The lyrics and the music, they were put together for people of all ethnics and all kind of race, color. It was just music that Berry kept asking his writers to make so that everyone would enjoy. You know, whether it was a fast song, a slow song, a middle song, just make it so that it's just pleasant to all the ears. And somehow or another, they made that formula happen, you know, because they crossed all the lines, all the barriers, all the age groups. And even now, when you hear those records, they still sound fresh.
Singer Levi Stubbs, you were classmates at Pershing High in Detroit, right? Pershing High Doughboys?
Yes, we are. Graduated in January of 54. You know, we used to sing. I was an athlete, and I ended up with a scholarship to play basketball. You know, I played basketball, football, ran track. And so in between January and September, you know, Levi and I just thought about, let's try singing. Maybe we can make some money. You know, so I can add to my little scholarship and go to college correctly. Wow. Well, I have to tell you, the first night that we got together to sing professionally, we all knew we had. Now, we all had plans, that the four of us, you know, had different plans. But Levi, his plan was always, I just want to sing. After that first night on stage, it was in Flint, Michigan. At Eddie's Lounge. Yeah, I'll never forget it. But once we started singing, our voices just blended and melted. It was like, it just came out great, and the blend was extraordinary. So we all looked at each other afterwards and said, man, this is a group. Let's really start, get rehearsing, and start a real group. And we did. The very next day, we really got down to business.
And the rest is Motown history. You know, I think, and so I have visited that little house at 2648 West Grand Boulevard. The world knows mm-hmm. it. Now is the Motown Museum, but you were there. Tell us and take us into it. Duke, what was it like when the Tops and the other Motown greats were recording there? Was it really going around the clock?
You could go and hang out at night and then stop by there at 2:30, 3 o'clock in the morning when the clubs closed and listen to someone recording. It was 24 hours. But most of the time in the daytime, the artists would come, and we would sit in the reception hall, and we'd talk about our dreams, hopes, and wishes. And little by little, one by one, those things came true. Now, when you go into that building right now and you see how small it was, it is just amazing of all the recordings that we did that came out of there with all the different personalities. It's just amazing. We go down there now and say, wow, we did all that in here? What a wonderful, wonderful place.
Between all of the different Motown artists, would you say collaborative or competitive or some of both?
It was like a family, but competitive. Hmm. I mean, we were, you know, being around there was like, it was like a college student center, you know. We would all be there looking, listening to different writers and producers and discussing things with each other, maybe playing cards with each other, maybe playing basketball out in the back with the Temptations or the Miracles. It was a family, and it was a true family, and there was a lot of love that still exists, you know.
Yeah.
And that's not just something that's been said. It was a true feeling. Everybody really cared for each other. And anyway, each one could help the other. We would, but we still were competitive. When you get on that stage, we did not want the other artists, whether it be a girl, whether it be a bunch of girls, or whether it be another group of boys, you didn't want nobody to outdo you. So we have this theory that if you stay in your lane and do your thing at A-plus condition, timing, and sound, then you'll be all right. So don't fool around listening to, you know, well, I got to do better than, you know, just do the best that you can for what you, that's what we all learn. And everybody was always competing, and the audience always got a number one show.
And when you stop and think about where the Four Tops and other Motown acts stand in, really, in American music, were you aware at the time how you were taking down barriers? You were breaking through and speaking to all audiences, playing all over. Was that a conscious awareness of the fact you were really breaking down barriers?
At first, it really wasn't, because it was all just so exciting, and it was just a lot of fun making hits and knowing that people around the world was buying your records. And it was more of that than anything. Then after a few years, say maybe in starting about the late 60s, or maybe just a little before, you start realizing that this music is making an impact in every kind of way. In all the cultures, it was making an impact. It was being played in some houses where our black music was not being played. And it was all across the world. I mean, you could be number one in Brazil, and then number one in Australia, number one in England. I mean, it was just absolutely amazing that little seed that's planted right there in Detroit grew to be such a global flower. And it's just amazing how it caught on with the world. And you could go to other countries and do concerts. They couldn't speak English, but they would know the words to them songs. It was the most thrilling thing that we went through at that particular time, is knowing that the impact that it was making, and also knowing eventually that during the civil rights movement, Motown music kind of opened the door a little bit. You know, it was just kind of seeped into them homes, and you know, when you see the Motown artists on TV, you know, it changed how people was looking at us, because we were all very well dressed and very well prepared for stage, and the sound, the look, everything was great. And it kind of softened the blow of the civil rights movement. So that's one of the things we're most proud of. Disappointment haunts me through each lonely day. The world around I see in only shades of gray. But when the love light shines upon my face, I'm in a different world.
And when you sing, here you are still singing today, and I it seems very clear that if Lawrence and Obie and Levi had not passed away, all four of you would still be singing together.
Absolutely.
And that's so rare in music, where people leave groups blow up and break up entirely. Why do you think the four of you stuck together the way you did, so more than 40 years?
Well, 44 to be exact. Well, first of all, we were brought up in another, it was almost like another land. It's another culture. You know, back in the 50s, that's when we started, 1954. So I've been doing this for 64 years. So anyway, it was a whole nother culture. You know, we were raised different, you know. We had respect for certain things. We looked at certain things. We had parameters that we had to go by. And And we wanted to show people how well we could dress, how well we could talk, how well we could sing. It was like we needed to make an impression, but, you know, but making it from our heart, you know, and not, you know, making the impression is the thing that you do. But we felt like we had to do that to kind of move along and kind of climb those steps. It was a total different society there. And, you know, you'd have to live there to really understand the difference between this and now. It's two different worlds altogether.
And you still have people coming to cheer. And the Legends of Motown show will be happening July 14th, Freedom Hill in Sterling Heights, the Four Tops, the Temptations, and the Stylistics. Abdul Duke Fakir, thank you so much for spending time with us on Stateside. I know you're going to have a great time with the audience at Freedom Hill on the 14th.
Thank you, Cynthia. It's been my pleasure speaking.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. Coming up, as robots begin to look and sound more like real humans, how will that change the way we interact with them in our everyday lives?
You won't be going to a retirement home or a hospital. You'll have a personal robot that will take care of you.
That is in 10 minutes. You're listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. There are calls today for a state investigation into why the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality apparently failed to act on a warning of PFAS contamination, a warning written in 2012. Human studies suggest PFAS exposure is linked to some cancers, thyroid problems, higher cholesterol, and other diseases. Here's Lisa Wozniak, Executive Director of the Michigan League of Conservation Voters.
The fact that this report was suppressed for 6 years is appalling and inexcusable, and at this point there is a dire need for full transparency and a complete investigation into what took place within the DEQ between 2012 and today.
MLive's Garrett Ellison broke the story earlier this week about an MDEQ employee writing a 93-page report in 2012 that warned of a looming health crisis. A report that was basically ignored. Garrett is now with us via Skype. Garrett, just to refresh everyone's collective memories, how many PFAS contamination sites have now been identified in Michigan?
Oh, boy. I believe the number is 31, 32. It's hard to keep track of it at this point. It's about 15 communities is probably a better way to look at it, but it's a lot and more seemingly every week and every month.
So tell us, who was Robert Delaney? Who is this longtime DEQ employee who wrote the report? What's his expertise and specialty?
Well, Bob Delaney, he's a Superfund section site manager. He deals with toxic sites, and he was the site manager for the DEQ at Wordsmith Air Force Base in Oscoda. And he's a expert in the environmental fate and transport of contaminants. So he's the guy who figures out where the plumes are going, essentially.
So what was Bob Delaney's message? What was his warning in this report that he wrote in 2012?
Well, Bob Delaney learned that there was PFAS contamination at Wordsmith in 2010. And over the course of the next few years, he became increasingly concerned about what he was learning about these chemicals and their ubiquity in industry and commerce. You know, we've learned how widespread their usage is now. And, you know, he was raising the alarm, essentially, with his superiors, and he was trying to get them to take this seriously in 2012. He brought in a Colorado toxicologist to essentially boil down the findings of the C8 health study, the Parkersburg, West Virginia DuPont poisoning, and essentially take that to his superiors and say, hey, we have this problem at Wordsmith. We very, very likely have it in many other places in Michigan because we've got data, some selective sampling data from around the state that indicates we have PFAS in surface waters. We're finding it at incredibly high levels in the fish around Fort Smith Air Force Base, and we really need to do something about it. Let's get in front of it. And the report went to Dan Wyatt, the former DEQ director, and it didn't really go much further than that.
And even in this report, Delaney had an action plan, wasn't it?
Yeah, he laid out what has essentially become the roadmap for the state's creation of MPART, the Michigan PFAS Action Response Team that Governor Snyder's office created in November. Now, Snyder administration officials say that, you know, this was, you know, Delaney's report was not the reason. It was not the thing that they used to create MPART. But if you read Delaney's report and then you read, you know, what MPART is and does, it's pretty much they're doing everything that he recommended. You know, he said we need a multi-agency response across statewide. We need to fund dosage response studies and sampling water systems around the state, map blood serum levels around the state, check food supplies, drinking water supplies, you know, develop a statewide in-home carbon filtration program in quotes to get as many people off impacted water as possible.
Very prophetic.
Very much.
And so here, as you're saying, you, through all the emails that you got through the Freedom of Information Act, you see Robert Delaney had worries about PFAS going back to 2010 because of what he was doing in Oscoda around Fort Smith. He wrote emails. He gave talks. He wrote this 93-page report in 2012. So how did this report come to light?
Well, you know, it was sort of among people who were dealing with Delaney over the years, it, you know, it sort of got out there in some ways. And there's a radio personality in Lansing named Steve Gruber, and he somehow got a copy of it, and he convinced Delaney to come on the radio and discuss the report with him. That was in October. And about that time, right after Delaney went on the radio, suddenly he became very difficult to reach. He was somebody who had always been pretty open to answering his phone and talking about PFAS, especially related to Fort Smith and Oscoda. After that, he was difficult to reach, and within a month, the state created MPART.
And he continues to be difficult to reach.
Yes. He is not completely out of sight up in Oscoda, given his involvement in that site. He's on the local restoration advisory board. He participates in public meetings. But my attempts over the last 6 months to talk to him through official channels have been met with pushback.
Garrett, as you read the documents and then you spoke with scientists and lawmakers, what did you hear? Does anyone have any sense of why the warning was not acted on? Did they offer any perspectives?
You know, Delaney's co-author, Richard Grandchamp, a Colorado toxicologist, he was really disappointed that it didn't really go much further than the DEQ director's desk. I think there's some speculation that it may have been seen as a bit of a Chicken Little situation. A report lands on the director's desk, essentially says the sky's falling and you need to spend millions of dollars to address it. And, you know, there just may not have been the will to do anything about it.
And we know Dan Wyatt eventually was replaced because of problems in the response to the Flint crisis. But this was years before Flint became a thing. That did not begin till spring of 2014.
Yes, this was, this was before PFAS was on really anybody's radar in Michigan in a real way outside of environmental specialists and toxicologists and whatnot.
But they weren't distracted by Flint either.
Exactly. It's one of these things where you're reading through this report and you're reading through the emails that I obtained from the year 2010, even earlier. It's surprising how similar the concerns he's expressing back in 2010 are to what's being expressed today. It's almost verbatim the same concerns that we're only hearing now as, you know, an explanation for this emerging contamination problem. He was raising the same questions that people are raising today, like, what about the replacement chemicals for PFOS and PFOA? We don't know much about the toxicity of those, but, you know, that there's no reason to believe that they're not as harmful. What about the effect on the food supply? You know, how far do these things spread? And, you know, a lot of these questions we're still trying to answer.
MLive's Garrett Ellison. Garrett, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
From the Jetsons' Rosie to Data on Star Trek, robot companions have long held a special place in pop culture.
Danger, Will Robinson! Danger!
Exterminate! You read me, Hal?
Affirmative, Dave.
I may be homely, Buster, but I'm S-M-A-R-T smart.
But now artificial intelligence is moving off the screen and into our everyday lives. And as that happens, robots are starting to look and sound more like real humans. So how might that change the way that we interact with robots? What kinds of ethical issues do robots with human-like qualities pose? To explore these questions, we have Lionel Robert here with us. He's an associate professor at the University of Michigan School of Information.
Well, we make them more human-like because it increases our acceptance of the robot. We tend to trust robots that are more like us. So the more human they are, the more we want to interact with them.
And some of your recent research was looking at human employees and their willingness to trust robots and work with robots. What did you find out about the way that humans were interacting with their robot colleagues?
So what we found out was that to what degree people believed the robot was similar to them in terms of gender and personality, they were more likely to trust the robot and want to work with the robot.
So give me an example.
So we looked at things like the robot's personality, their attitude toward work. To what degree you shared the same beliefs about work, showing up for work, the amount of work you do, the amount of time you put in there, to what degree that was similar to a robot, you had a higher propensity to trust that robot.
So what kind of application? Let's say, because when we think workplace robots, I think a lot of us are kind of back years ago with, you know, the painting robots in the in the auto line, but we're seeing them used in different ways working alongside people, aren't we?
Yeah, so in our study, what we did was there was a robot that could work with you in a warehouse. Mm-hmm. And so basically it could move around just like a human, and in essence, it was as functional as a human. So in that sense, there's no limit to how human a robot can become and what aspect we can engage in a robot.
So what do you see as the main benefits for companies in making these workplace robots more personable?
So one, you increase acceptance by their coworkers. The coworkers will enjoy interacting with them. They won't be so hostile. I think now that there's a big concern that human workers are having more negative attitude to our robots because they know that those robots are replacing either someone they know's job or could eventually replace their job.
So it almost sounds like it's a double-edged sword. If you make that robot more human-like, I might be inclined to work with it, but I also might project suspicions on it?
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, it becomes easier to see how that robot is replacing your job or your friend when the more human it is. If the robot is sort of like a giant arm, well, you see it as a giant arm,
yeah.
No big deal. But if it actually has two legs and two hands and it's walking around and talking, all of a sudden it looks like a competitor.
And can you point to examples of robots being used in the workplace in a way that does not displace humans?
So I think what people are now looking at are robots that basically enable workers. So, for example, in healthcare, mm-hmm. right now there's a lot of healthcare technology and automation used to support the doctors making decisions. Same thing in the military. A lot of automation is designed to support the humans making better decisions, and mainly because those are two areas where someone's life is on the line, and when mistakes are made, you can only hold a human accountable. So in those cases, we want to design technology to support humans, not to replace them.
So the jobs that might be dangerous or dirty or very, very much a drudge job, we could see shifting those to the robots and freeing that human for better stuff?
So that's the idea. But I would pause a second because I hear this argument a lot. But it depends on who you're talking to when you say those jobs that are drudge and freeing humans up. Most of our workforce are people who pick up heavy things, and people mm-hmm. who engage in manual labor. And telling those people that, you know, you're going to have all this extra time to do wonderful things. Yeah, for those people, this is not going to be something to free up extra time over and above the fact that they would be unemployed.
Now, robots obviously are not just showing up at work. They are getting into our homes. Give us some ideas of where robots either are being used in homes now or it's coming soon.
What's coming soon is that when you get past a certain age where you need help, you won't be going to a retirement home or a hospital. You'll have a personal robot that will take care of you. The robot will be your companion, your nurse, and in some cases it can be your lover, maybe. And so that robot is going to be the person that takes you around, a companion. Your kids will be able to call that robot to see how you're doing. And that's where I think a big push is going to come over the next 20 years when it comes to using robots in the home.
And very important, as opposed to a Roomba going around vacuuming the floor, to have those human-like qualities.
Exactly.
What kinds of qualities might we see? What's being engineered?
So we're going to see robots designed to fit the typical human perception of beauty. Robots are going to fit what we think are beautiful. Size, shape, voice, all those things are going to be designed such a way that we find those things attractive.
There was a case in Canada where a man was arrested for buying a sex robot made in Japan in the form of a young girl.
Exactly. So this is a problem with that, is that when we humanize robots, we change our expectations of the robot, but also of other people's behavior toward the robot. So in that example, you can say it's a robot. That person can do whatever they want to do with their robot. But because it appears to be an underage girl, our expectations about what they can do with that robot fundamentally changes.
So are we breaking down social norms then with this ability to make such a lifelike robot?
I think so. We could eventually get to the same point when we had slaves. Right? There was something about owning slaves that really hurt the owner in ways that the owner didn't appreciate. It's an element of dehumanization. And it's not clear to me that that won't happen when we have robots that will look and appear to be human that we are around.
So how does that get addressed so that we look into it before it happens to us?
So I think right now the push is to see if we can do it. That's the push. Everyone's trying to see if we can do it and leverage the benefits of it. I don't think anyone's thinking about should we do it or what kind of problems it's going to have, right? I mean, now we know that sexual robots is a growing industry. And as these robots become more human-like, that's one particular industry that's going to benefit the most. But we never stop to ask, is that something that we really want? Is there harm to our societies when people begin to develop relationships with robots and not other people?
You know, it strikes me that what you're talking about reminds me of HBO's Westworld.
Yes.
When you're thinking about the questions that raises, which comes to, is the technology getting ahead of our ability to create kind of ethical norms and laws that regulate how we humans are going to use robots?
I think it is, because I think right now we're in part assuming that it's just going to be a machine. Mm. I don't think we're understanding the implications of when it crosses that line, when that robot becomes indistinguishable from a human, and the consequences of that.
So that's where your research is looking?
Exactly. Looking at the implications of that. I'm trying to signal that, hey, there's some downsides to this. I'm not saying we shouldn't do it, but I think we should begin to think about the problems associated with it.
What kind of policy changes might you, as you kind of think about what's coming in this age to come of humanized technology, what kind of policy changes do you find yourself thinking maybe we need to look at this?
Well, you know, we know that corporations are humans too, right? Or people too, right? Mm-hmm. So there's no reason why a robot can't have rights. There's no reason why a robot can't engage in a relationship. I mean, we think now that's crazy, but a lot of things that are perfect example. When the Dallas shooter got killed, I don't know if you remember this case of Dallas, they used a robot to go and find the shooter, and they attached C4 to the robot. It found the person, and it blew up. Now, maybe 100 years ago, we would use a dog to do that. Today, that's unacceptable. We would never have tolerated use of a dog. You can fast forward 100 years from now, and it may be unacceptable to use a robot in that manner.
Lots of questions being dug into by Lionel Robert, who's Associate Professor of the Robotics Institute at the University of Michigan. Thank you so much for sharing your work with us.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Stateside's executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. contributors are Mike Blank, Joey Heron, Sarah Leeson, Sophie Sherry, Lindsay Scullin, and April Van Buren. Stateside is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.